Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, I'm on the train. Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast on the Times. I'm Matt Chorley, stuck on a train, unable to get into the studio to record this week's podcast. The first time this has happened in 3.5 years and more than 200 episodes. Waiting in the studio to discuss what's happening in British politics, Rachel Sylvester, Times columnist, on how climate change is causing divisions in the Conservative Party as deep as Brexit. Making her podcast debut, the brilliant Janice Turner, on whether sex strikes can ever work. Plus, Times political editor Frances Elliott on the newish political kids on the block. I don't know what they're going to say either, so let's sit back and listen to it together.
The Brexit Party has not produced a manifesto ahead of the European Parliament elections, but says it will publish one afterwards. Is that breathtaking cynicism or strategic brilliance? It's both, surely. I mean, this is quite extraordinary. I can't remember the last time a political party fought an election with failing to have any sort of prospectus about what it would do. This is what Farage actually said when he was challenged about this. He said, "This is a deliberate tactic being used by everyone else because they want to get away from having a proper debate about the extent to which our Brexit vote and the promises made to us in a general election have been betrayed, the extent to which we've been let down, the extent to which we've been humiliated. Thereafter, of course, we will talk about policies, but I have to emphasise this. I will never, ever use that word manifesto. I think that most people's word association, manifesto equals lie." I mean, this is kind of absolutely brilliant. So not only is he helping himself to the fact that he's not going to have a manifesto, he's justifying it on the equation that everybody else's manifesto is a lie. It just underlines the extent to which, you know, the rest of the political establishment is playing croquet and he's cage fighting. You know, he has said that he went away and studied the Donald Trump election. He's obviously given it some deep thought. And one conclusion I think he's come to is that, you know, all the niceties that we have about how elections and democracies should work are just, they're up for grabs. You don't have to have a manifesto. And in a sense, you know, why should they have a manifesto? What's the point? I mean, you know, he's right, isn't he? I mean, everybody puts these things in. I mean, you know, populists previously have just made promises that they can't keep. Why not make no promises at all, and then you can't break them?
And the problem is it's the exactly what's happened with the whole Brexit debate. So the referendum in 2016 had no definition of Brexit. So it allowed people to project onto that whatever they wanted, and it was a negative vote about anything, you know, the status quo, about the establishment. And what Farage is cleverly, cynically doing is allowing people to, is deliberately creating a vehicle for a protest vote, but in actually quite a dangerous way, because then somebody who's actually got to run the country, manage Brexit, deliver Brexit, has to work out what it means, and it's never going to be possible to do that without a lot of people feeling it's either a betrayal or a breach of trust. So the problem is politics and government depends on facts and reality, and Farage and the populists are selling fantasy, and those two worlds just don't meet.
Except they do meet at the polling booth.
But they meet at the polling booth, but in reality, yeah. They've got to be delivered. You know, something's got to happen.
Why would you have a manifesto of any sort before this election, before the European elections? Because, quite honestly, it's a proxy referendum again, isn't it? That's how he sees it. And whatever you think of him, whatever monstrous human being or Trumpian character he is, he understands the proposition that is being voted on, which is, for his people, Brexit hasn't been delivered. So who cares what he thinks about climate change or education or the health service? This is all about delivering Brexit.
And I think got a commitment on Brexit, which is a no deal.
Yeah, and Brexit. I think that he understands what is going on. But, and it's the rest of the parties that aren't really, as we've seen, the kind of chaos in places like Peterborough, are not really seeing the proposition clearly.
It is actually the case that the Conservatives also do not have a manifesto.
Do Labour have one?
I think Labour do have a manifesto. Bless them, because they stick to the rules. They're still playing croquet merrily away. I think Theresa May didn't quite fancy drawing up a manifesto of her own. But yeah, I mean, I just do think a kind of pass has been sold if we let, you know, and we appear to be completely content to let him get away with not having any kind of prospectus.
Well, it's like not wanting to be challenged by the BBC on historic statements.
Yeah.
And, you know, actually, what are your values? What do you believe? Do you stand by that? Is a completely legitimate line of questioning. And what he's doing is he's trying to demonise what he calls the mainstream media so that he can't be held to account. Yeah. It's all about vilification.
The more we howl, the kind of happier it is, in a sense. Mm. I mean, it just, you know, it proves that he's doing something right. Every protest that we make,
we're bringing facts to the culture war, which that guy said with Trump, yeah. One of the American journalists. And it is
never a good idea, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily our job to fight, but his opponents certainly need to wake up to what he's doing. And it is absolutely brilliant. I mean, you know, you wonder how far they can go. You know, why bother having elections at all? I mean, come on.
But surely they're going to have a manifesto for general election, aren't they? Or if they get to that point. Well, I mean, it seems to me that the two main parties, Labour and the Tories, they are not going to get back to normal business until we are through some form of Brexit, until there is either Mrs. May's deal's gone through, or there's been a referendum, or there's been some sort of statement or clearance of this whole blockage. And so, you know, until then, why would he not go on this platform? I think he is a genius at this whole debate now. He's the only person who's got the bull by the horns. I mean, he's appalling. I don't support him at all, but he has this clarity. And the places like where I come from in Doncaster, they completely get that. I mean, there's been a sort of a shock among the London media going up to places like Pontefract, for example, and Doncaster, and to see him do rallies. I'm not surprised at all.
Well, given the last 3 months or even 6 months of, you know, political ridiculous stasis, game-playing nonsense at Westminster, I don't think anybody can be remotely surprised that, you know, there is an anti-politics sentiment out there. And, you know, it's no particular surprise that Nigel Farage is the immediate beneficiary of it being outside the whole system. You know, but you're right, as soon as the Brexit Party is going to have a very good election, no doubt, and then they will be straight onto the kind of Westminster shtick, and I think the air will go out of the balloon reasonably quickly. And I, you know what, I think kind of punters also know what they're doing. I think they know that this is a free kick.
Do you think they're quite
educated into how to do protest politics?
Yeah.
The UK, you know.
Does
UKIP
it affect
was 24%
and went
straight back
to the UK? Do you think it affects what happens with Brexit, whether or not we get a harder Brexit or a softer Brexit or a referendum? And does this have any impact?
Well, Crispin Blunt has already been out of the block saying that, you know, we need to do seat deals with the Brexit Party. You know, the extent to which the Tory leadership campaign is now informed by how do you deal with Nigel Farage? Do you deal with him, or do you confront him and deal? Just, I mean, you know, I mean, how do you kind of cope with him? So he's already kind of colouring the and will probably, to some extent, determine the winner of the Tory leadership contest.
Prime minister.
There is a very good argument saying he's the most influential politician of the modern age. He basically He did this before. He delivered Brexit by forcing David Cameron to have a referendum in the first place.
Mm. It's sort of influenced from the side.
Yeah, it's kind of, and it's.
So does it make it more like
a guy who's never won a part policy? Yes, I think it probably does. Or revoke, actually. You know,
it goes to the one side or the other.
The binary choice is becoming, you know, forced upon us.
Mm. So when are we going to find that out? What's going to happen, do you think? When's the crunch moment? We keep having all these crunch weeks.
This is the D-Day today.
Yeah.
I think that a Tory leadership election cannot be far off. Mm. I think that that sets up a another confrontation with Brussels around October. I don't think this Parliament will ever countenance no deal, and therefore I think a general election on the premise of no deal or revoke is almost inevitable.
I spoke to a cabinet minister last week who said exactly that scenario, except at the end they said that the new hard Brexit leader would much prefer to have a referendum in that situation than a general election. Because say Boris or Dominic Raab comes in, they've just got into number 10. Do they really want to risk being prime minister, their whole premiership, on a general election? And wouldn't it be more sensible for them at that point to cauterise the issue of Brexit, have a referendum on it, on, as you say, no deal or remain?
Yes, but you've got Farage crying blue murder and betrayal at the, you know, at the other end. And how do you get
Farage at one point advocated
again, you're bringing facts to the culture war. I mean, you know, come on, consistency. Yeah. That's another of those old-fashioned croquet rules that we don't bother with anymore. I think it's not impossible, but I think that, you know, and to contradict myself, I think... To get to the leadership, I think the candidates will probably have to rule out a referendum,
right?
And whether or not they can,
they also have to rule out a general election. So it's all
going to have to rule out quite a lot.
How does it fall at the moment in terms of a majority who would vote tomorrow for a referendum?
In the House of Commons,
yes.
I think you wouldn't get much beyond 200. Or 215 max.
More Tories, wouldn't you?
Yeah, a hell of a lot more Tories. I mean, you see some Tories nibbling at it.
It's definitely moving in that direction.
But it's well short of a parliamentary majority.
I mean, I've got to the position now where I just care about social fabric, and I wonder if a lot of other people are starting to feel the same, that unless we find some way of finally settling this issue, we're going to rip apart. I mean, I care about that far more than whether we stay or leave now. Mm. I just want there to be a way of moving on to normal politics again and talking about social care or the environment or education. And I was against the second referendum in the beginning because I thought it was... sort of some version of democracy, but now I think if there's some sort of
you're the Just Make It Stop party.
This is
quite a lot.
I mean, I've actually started to feel for the first time in my life that this idea of a strong man, and it would be a strong man government like we have in Erdogan in Turkey or Trump in America, there is an appetite growing in the confusion and wreckage of Brexit. And I think unless we get things back on a stable footing, of what we used to be before, that's where we're going to be. And Farage, of course, you know, is a major candidate for that role.
Salvini.
And the problem is neither side are happy. So the Brexiteers see the withdrawal agreement as a fudge they can't accept. The Remainers aren't happy either. And each side has become further more and more polarised. It's very hard to see how you reach a resolution without...
Well, I think the referendum, and a referendum in which all the options are on the table, really. I mean, everyone says it'll be like Mrs May's deal or remain, or Mrs May's deal and leave. I think there has to be some sort of single transferable vote kind of thing where you can say your first, second and third options, and then we can finally resolve it.
Mm. Rachel.
So moving on to non-Brexit subjects, actually. The photo of David Cameron hugging huskies in the Arctic symbolised his brand of modernisation. He replaced the Tory torch with a Conservative tree and told the electorate they could vote blue, go green. But one of Theresa May's first acts as Prime Minister was to scrap the Department for Energy and Climate Change, and now the Tories are deeply divided over the environment between interventionists and free marketeers. I think what's interesting is this whole debate about climate change, the environment, air quality has become almost a proxy for the battle for the future of the Tory party, with the more sort of modernisers, outlooking, open Tories wanting to do more on the environment, and the more traditional ERG side opposing it. And it's also interesting that there's a real debate. It goes to the heart of what the Tory party is. So should the Tories be intervening, using the power of government to make the world a better place? Or is it all the sort of laissez-faire, free marketeer, Liz Truss talking about, you know, we don't want meddling in people's lives, telling them not to use wood-burning stoves, goves, whatever she calls them. And there's also an issue about cost of living. So people like Rob Halfon, who's one of the kind of blue-collar Tories who wants to... he's campaigned on fuel prices and that kind of thing. He says this is a sort of metropolitan issue and it doesn't go down well in working class seats like his. He thinks we've got to be focusing on the cost of living, not sort of middle class environmentalism balanced on the backs of the poor. Mm. So this is about much more than the environment. Mm. The other thing that I think's interesting, I was looking at the research when I was writing my column this week, is that there's a link. The people who voted for Brexit are also more likely to be sceptical on climate change and the reality of climate change. And it plays into this whole issue of values.
And generation.
And generations and education. And it's so it's become a sort of totemic issue in the Tory party.
Well, do you remember before Brexit, the thing that Labour was vulnerable on under Ed Miliband was actually, you know, his commitment to the green agenda and, you know, green crap, as David Cameron used to call it. And I, you know, what I was struck by the rapidity and the vigour with which Corbyn and McDonnell leaned into the Extinction Rebellion stuff. And they really kind of like, they really, really embraced it. And I think they did that mostly because they're exquisitely sensitive to the Greens. Mm. You know, they hate the Greens on their patch, and they in their universe, actually, the Greens are a much bigger threat to them than the Lib Dems.
That's their biggest seepage of voters is from the Remain voting Labour people to the Greens.
Yeah, and so that's, so you know, there is absolutely no chance that Labour's won't be firmly on the sort of climate, you know, climate change mitigation measures, and there's some sort of chunky stuff coming down the track. We know we're going to have to be asked to do some things that we don't want to do, like eat less meat. You know, I've got to get rid of my diesel car. I know that. You know, it's annoying, but I'm going to have to do it. And it's going to cost, you know.
Change our boilers.
All sorts of things. Yeah, really kind of nasty things that we've been putting off, but we know are coming. And, they will alienate a lot of kind of certainly low-income people. Mm. And it's another kind of opportunity, as it were, for a blue-collar, blue-wave populist outfit, Trumpian perhaps, to get in there. And you're absolutely right. And then the Conservatives are completely split on it. I mean, they, you know, it was supposed to be the issue which reconnected Conservatives with their Remain-leaning metropolitan voters. Mm. And, you know, that's how it was billed by Gove. That's, you know, that was the whole political plan, if you remember. We don't hear quite so much about that anymore.
And there's something very sort of small-c conservative about sustainability and the environment.
I mean, it worked for them because it kind of linked them to, you know, the Countryside Alliance in a certain degree. I mean, obviously there's certain...
I don't think it's quite as stark as you're painting it, really. I mean, The Times has our very wonderful campaign on air quality, but for quite a few years now, the Daily Mail, right at the heart of the sort of Tory vote, has been running a campaign on plastics, which has been really successful, litter picking, clearing up and so on, which, you know, goes back to a sort of old-fashioned agenda of cleaning up your community. But also, they were very, very on the top of the push to plastic bag tax and things like that. So I think among ordinary voters, right-leaning, you know, sort of in centre voters that would probably vote Tory, is a sense of the environment being important. I think if you posed it about climate change and polar bears and Extinction Rebellion, they wouldn't be up for it. But I think on a broader level, they are pro it. And I don't think they're against things like little nudges, for example, like on Michael Gove, some of his things on recycling plastic bottles and
straws.
I don't think they would agree with this trust. I think she's being quite sort of trollish about it, saying, oh, it doesn't matter about your plastic straws. Lots of people really care about this stuff, and they're not all on the left.
But I think from Theresa May's point of view, she seems more comfortable with that kind of David Attenborough type environment. environmentalism, then more of the Greta Thunberg, things that are going to cost us as consumers, push up energy prices, reduce flying, push up the cost of driving. And it's those, if you think about the sort of white van man person that Robert Halfon and people are trying to appeal to, that's not the kind of policy that she's doing. But there are some other Tories who feel you have to go much further and embrace both sides of it.
Well, I think that what the Tories, if they had any sense, would do is try to help people lower down. I've just changed my my diesel car because I think it comes in quite... Oh, is it coming already?
That you Boulez.
Can't, yeah, you can't drive through the congestion zone at any time of... So I've got a hybrid car now. I'm feeling very virtuous. But I was just thinking about people who really need their cars, who have to drive into that zone.
It's $12.50 a day.
It's $12.50 a day, but also to replace the car is a significant investment. And all over the country are these kind of, you know, I haven't seen pictures of them yet. I'd love to see, but of all these diesel cars sitting forlornly and unloved, you know, everybody's getting rid of them. But there could be some mechanism for supporting people a bit better.
And that's what I think the Tory party isn't very comfortable with. Government, state support, state subsidy for changing. Yeah. They want it all to be nudges and tidying plastic, things without a cost. Yes. And actually either the taxpayer or the tax system.
But then you've got the Green New Deal in America, which is like a kind of recipe for absolute massive state intervention, is seen by the right as a sort of like Trojan horse to completely kind of rewrite the rules and of massive government subsidies. So, so yeah, I mean, clearly we're going to be asked to do ever more politically difficult things as this crisis unfolds, and that is going to shape politics in more profound ways than Brexit, I think.
There's also a sort of generational thing here, I think. So as with Brexit, the young are much more concerned about climate change, and the Onward research recently, which found that the average age at which people tip over into voting Tory is now 51, up from 47 at the last election. And if the Tories can't win over some of the school strikers, you know, some of the Extinction Rebellion people, they've got to get some younger voters from somewhere. And if they look like they're turning their back on, you know, Europe, they're turning their back on climate change, they're looking increasingly out of touch with the sort of that younger generation, that's going to be very dangerous for them politically.
I wonder about the young, though, because on the one level, there are all these incredibly... I mean, I have children of 23 and 21, so I sort of see that generation coming into my house and so on. And on one level, they are very concerned about it. And I just wonder, though, about the sacrifices that generation is willing to make, because... A, in my experience, they do not recycle. If all the beer cans in my bin, even on that small example, are they prepared to give up all their devices? Are they prepared to give
up?
Did
you know music streaming? Are they going to give up more CO2 than having a record?
It's amazing. Are they going to give up travel?
Right.
Yeah, because of all the power that you need to do all the servers to keep it going. They're very, very ungreen music streaming.
The most extraordinary statement by Caroline Lucas the other day, and it really made me sit up sharp, was that we're not supposed to fly except once every 5 or 6 years. And I thought, my goodness, I will give up meat, I will give up my car, I will walk everywhere. But the idea of spending the rest of my life in Cornwall, I mean, Cornwall's wonderful. Oh, Scotland's wonderful.
Apology to Cornish readers.
But, no, I spent all my childhood holidays.
The seaside towns are available.
But, you know, the idea that we won't be allowed to travel the world, and I've travelled a lot already, so it's not a great loss for me, but young people have this enormous appetite to see the world, and are they really going to do that? I don't know.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating. I'm sure I'm still stuck on a train. They'll be back after this short break.
If you enjoy listening to Times journalists talking about politics but would like to do it while at sea, you're in luck. Imagine me and Danny Finkelstein, plus Prue Leith, Pam Ayres, Armando Iannucci and Alan Johnson on a cruise ship. No, it's not a brand new reality TV show, but the brilliant Literary Festival at Sea 2020 on the Queen Mary 2. For details of this trip, organised by Times Expert Traveller, and to book your place on board, go to thetimes.co.uk/litfest2020 and quote the word Times when booking to get access to exclusive Times events.
A I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In America, actress and Me Too activist Elisa Milano has urged women in America to take part in a sex strike to protest against a new abortion law in the state of Georgia. It worked in the Greek comedy Lysistrata when women team up to bring about the end of the Peloponnesian War. So is denying sex a useful campaign tactic? And could it maybe even break the deadlock over Brexit? Let me first say that the laws changing in Georgia are pretty extraordinary. I mean, what the state legislature is doing is a challenge to Roe versus Wade and the legitimacy of abortion altogether. And it's going to mean life sentences for women who do it. There's some talk of them not being able to leave the state if they want an abortion. It is a really, really serious issue, but it was just an extraordinary thing that this actress, who's very big in Me Too, said that what women should do, and I guess she's talking about heterosexual women, is not have sex with men until Georgia state government does something about it. I don't know what people think about that. I mean, on one level, there is the attitude that it's a terrible thing that sex is something women give to men, and that we wouldn't enjoy ourselves, and therefore we have to stop. If we stop doing it, it's kind of self-defeating. But
and also that men are the people who are going to have the power to make the decision over this.
Yes.
Actually, you know, if women were in politics, then it wouldn't be up to the men to decide.
No, but there is also there's quite a long precedent besides in Greek comedies for sex strike. In 2003, Layman Gebawi organised a sex strike in Liberia to end the civil war, and she ended up with a Nobel Peace Prize. And in Kenya, in 2009, women enforced a sex ban until the political infighting ceased. And then there was a stable government within a week. And in the Philippines, a sex strike led to peace in a violence-plagued island. So, you know...
So with Brexit, who's not having sex with
this
who?
Is the question,
is it the Tory whips who are going to be denied sex by the MPs?
Well, I don't know. How would you think that might pan out in Parliament?
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Well, an observation.
Yes.
There's quite a lot of onanism, actually, in Brexit. So I'm not sure how a sex strike is going to hit the worst offenders.
Yeah.
I think a gazebo ban would actually possibly...
A gazebo ban?
Just stop them from appearing on television.
Right, yeah. They're not
sex
allowed...
with themselves that they most particularly...
Yeah, that narcissism ban, yeah. Yeah, I know. What if Nigel Farage and the Brexit Party had a policy of, like, we're not having sex until Brexit's delivered?
I think the Spartans are more interested in sovereignty than sex,
yeah,
aren't
true,
they?
That's
the
it?
Problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
But there is a sort of serious point here, which is that about a permanent secretary said to me the other day, there's this sense in Whitehall, they keep talking about this thing called learned helplessness, which is a sort of psychological theory drawn up by this man, Martin Seligman, I think it was in the 60s, where he did these experiments on dogs, which would definitely be banned now, but he put two groups of dogs. The first group, they were trained to turn off an electric current by pressing a lever. The second set of dogs didn't know how to do that. And then both sets were put into this sort of box with an electrocuted floor. And the ones that knew how to stop the pain of the current jumped out of the box to escape it. And the ones that didn't just lay down and whimpered. And what this permanent secretary says is that's what it feels like in Whitehall, that the civil servants feel helpless to do anything with their political masters are making a total mess of Brexit. Mm. There's no domestic policy going on. The voters, I think, also feel helpless. So the idea was that we're sort of laughing about the sex threat, but actually people want to be able to do something, sort of have a sense of re-empowerment about, they feel totally disempowered over this whole debate. And I think that's one of the problems.
Maybe there should be more sex. Actually, I mean, well...
Under Boris premiership, there is perhaps, Francis.
There is certainly not enough interaction between the Leave and Remain tribes. It's extraordinary how little they interact with one another.
Well, there was the Labour Party.
If more Leavers had sex with Remainers, perhaps we would actually kind of get
customs union babies.
I would think that the Remainers would be less likely to want to have sex with Leavers. Didn't they do all?
They
the,
do.
They did all these surveys which show that you'd be Remainers are more hostile to people on the other side than
yes.
Yeah, and then the Labour Party, of course, has those T-shirts that say "Never kissed a Tory."
Yes, which is awful.
Yeah, it's awful. The idea that
how incurious.
Yeah, exactly. So Tory curious. It's a new sexual preference.
It's all right. I'm nearly there. The train's just pulled into Waterloo. What do you mean they've finished? Well, a huge thank you to Frances Elliott, Janice Turner and Rachel Sylvester for holding the fort in my absence. If you want to listen to more of this hugely professional audio content, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Acast, Spotify or wherever you listen. And let us know what you thought of what they've been discussing while I've not been there by emailing redbox@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.